there, green future growers. Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer, and let's get growing.
Okay, so welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. It is July 11th, 2018, when we're talking, and I have an awesome guest on the line whose books have been recommended a few different times on the podcast, so I know he's going to have lots of golden seeds for us to learn from. So welcome to the show, Lee Wright.
Good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Garden-wise or otherwise?
Garden-wise.
Sure. Anyway, I did not grow up in agriculture. And a long, long time ago, I was in college in chemistry. And then I went to graduate school in chemistry. Then I dropped out of graduate school in chemistry and moved to Vermont for a year to sort of figure out what I was going to do. And I got really into reading about gardening. So I, after a year of not doing that much in Vermont, I decided to go to graduate school in agriculture, which I went to University of Wisconsin. And I also dove into gardening very intensively at the same time. I just was a crazy gardener at the time, and I was like learning a lot since I didn't come from an agricultural background. I didn't know anything. So I was learning a lot about soil science, especially because that's what I was in graduate school in. And then, after a few years, I was still in graduate school, and I decided to get a graduate degree in horticulture too, and still gardening crazily. I also had access to a really good agricultural library, so I used to read just about everything I could find besides doing it. And then I got my degrees. I worked for the what was then called the Soil Conservation Service of the USDA, which is now called the Natural Resource Conservation Service. And after a couple of years of that, I didn't like it that much, so I went back to graduate school and got my doctorate in horticulture with a specialty in fruit crops, and I worked for Cornell for a little while. And when that job ended, I went off on my own lecturing, writing, and consulting in agriculture. And the whole time, I just to point out that I did garden like a maniac, which I still do, and it sort of hasn't lost any of its appeal. I mean, the only problem is I garden a little too much, perhaps, but I still love it.
Well,
one other addition. So when I moved to New York to work for Cornell, I had a house with just 3/4 of an acre around it, and I planted everything I could, as far as fruit trees. But I only had 3/4 of an acre, so I called that a garden. And then I got access to a field just to the south of my property, which was another 2 acres, or a little over 2 acres. And instead of planting, say, two of some fruit tree, I decided to plant 20 since I write about them so I could study them better. And basically, I went crazy planting. And then I decided this could no longer be called a garden, so I renamed it a farm den. More than a garden, less a farm, and that's what I'm doing now.
Wow. Well, there's a ton there. So I actually usually start asking about your very first garden experience. Was that when you were in grad school, or like, did you ever garden as a kid at all? Or?
Well, actually, when I was very, very young, we lived in just north of New York City. And we had a house, and we had a small vegetable garden then. And I guess that would count as my first garden. It was just for a few years and was supplanted by a swing set. I wasn't that into gardening, though, at the time. I liked eating from the garden at that time. But I remember my father giving me this shovel, and he said, "Here, I want you to turn over the soil here." And I remember I was very little, like the shovel was taller than me. And I remember just trying to put the shovel in the ground, and it was like a rock. And it was like a stiff clay soil. And I couldn't do anything. So that was my first frustrating gardening experience.
Aww, I can totally picture you out there with the shovel. And that's tough when you have clay soil like that. And
yeah.
I still learn those lessons. Mike and I just went through that the other day. He was saying, "Don't try to dig there. Don't you see all the rocks and the clay? Dig it over here." So
well, since then, I I wrote a book a few years ago called Weedless Gardening, a very bold title that the publisher made up, but it does, I always say it's not weedless, it's weedless gardening. But anyway, the main theme of that book is, and that I practice for, over 25 years now, is no-till. So my garden soil has not been dug for many, many years. And I guess partially that comes from what I've learned over the years studying soil science and speaking to a lot of people and trying things out. But maybe it also goes back to trying to stick that shovel in the ground when I was a little kid.
I don't know even know where to start with my questions there. So you did all this school and started writing, but you were gardening the whole time. And then, I guess one big question I have, because a lot of my guests have talked about, like, when they went to school, they didn't really learn how to do it the organic way. And then, like, where'd you learn how to do the no-till thing? Like, just with practice or from reading? Or is that what they taught you at school? Or?
Oh, they definitely didn't teach that at school. And they definitely didn't teach organic gardening at school. Like, they do now, they do. But when I was studying soil science, any mention of organic gardening was sort of mentioned disparagingly. But
people have said on my show.
But still, it was sort of like I was learning basic soil science, which really basic soil science isn't organic or not organic. It's just basic soil science, and then it can be applied organically or not organically. So I really absorbed a lot of that information and then sort of used it from an organic perspective. And, and obviously a lot of the land grant colleges now, or most all of them, have really come around to noting the benefits of organic gardening. And I feel like I got a lot out of just learning the basics. And basically, I like to learn from books and do stuff out in the field. And that's what I was doing. I was trying things out, reading a lot, and just gardening a lot. And I think I consider myself to be lucky to have had that opportunity to have access to all that literature, access to the classroom, and to have a garden. I mean, from then on, I could not live any. I lived in a lot of places, and I could not live anywhere without a garden.
Aww. Well, that's perfect for listeners, because I feel like a lot of my listeners are like that. They're not as much new. I mean, there's definitely new gardeners out there, but a lot of my listeners are master gardeners, people who their whole backyard is like a garden. Like, they're just very, they've been doing it for a long time, kind of a lot like you have. So do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year or is growing well? Or?
Let me just say one more thing about the... I think a lot of people, I actually wrote a book that just came out this past spring called The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. And then this really relates to what I had said previously, because I think that people don't realize, the awesomeness, in the true sense of the word, of the science that's going on in the garden. And actually, you don't really have to, because, you have millions of years of evolution making plants grow. So you could stick a seed in the ground, and it's going to probably grow, even if you don't know anything about it. But my point is that if you learn a little more about what's happening out there, you get even better results. And I think one reason my garden really did get, for somebody that had no experience gardening, my garden was quite good very early on, just because I was learning so much about really what was going on behind the scenes with the plants and the soil.
Yeah. Well, that is definitely a huge theme of my show, is it's all about your soil health. And so if you have any tips for us on how we could improve our soil health, that would be awesome. Like, do you have any things for like people that you can say?
Tips?
Or is that
tips
too...
galore? I got tips galore on
On
soil health. one thing I was lucky that I did start out studying soil before I studied horticulture, because it really gave me a deep respect for the soil. And I hate to even throw out anything, because if you just throw out garbage around here, at least, it goes to a landfill, and it just seems like a disrespectful for the soil. But anyway, there's a lot of things. One thing is the whole thing about not tilling the soil. I think that's a really good way to care for the soil. It's not a religion, like, you know, it's like you're a bad person if you till the soil. But if you can manage a system where you don't have to till the soil, which I've managed to do, and a lot of people do now, it really does lead to a healthier soil for a number of reasons. First of all, you can really increase your soil organic matter, which I'm sure all the listeners know all the benefits of soil organic matter, both as far as the physical characteristics of the soil, the biological characteristics, and the nutritional characteristics. So you can really increase the soil organic matter. And you can also, when you till a soil, you really discombobulate fungi. You know, fungi have all these hyphae, little thin threads that run through the soil. And when you till a soil, it just breaks them all up. And same thing with worms. You know, it seems sort of obvious that worms would not like a soil that's being tilled up all the time. So not tilling the soil, I would say that's one of the main things. Really making a healthy soil. Another really important thing is just related to that is building up organic matter as much as possible, you know, with compost, manures, cover crops, things like that. And I've been lucky because I've been in the same place now for over 30 years, and my soil organic matter levels are super high, and the soil is like nice and soft and really a joy to work in.
Well, you know, that's something that we've come up with, my husband and I, where we are here. And also, I know listeners, like, where do you come up with that good soil? Like, if you're building new beds or if you're, you know, we're constantly expanding. Like, my husband, every year he grows a little more. And, like, now he's finally got this thing I call the mini farm that's, I don't know, maybe a quarter of an acre, a third of an acre, somewhere in there. And just we're always trying to, like, anytime he puts in new beds, because we have like 260 feet of fence around our house that's separate from the mini farm. And that's where he used to garden. And he has a lot of deep beds there. But every time we, you know, it's finding soil, finding compost. And I'm really curious about what you said about, like, because I kind of feel this way that it's almost disrespectful to be throwing things out. Like, I just think that's something. But by that, do you mean, like, just organic matter, or, like, are you talking about, like, when you pull up a crop, like, you know, turning in the greens and stuff, you know, like if you pull up your beets or something, say, you know, turning in beet greens or the peas, like, what's Mike just about to harvest? He's been growing fava beans this year, and he grew beans for the, you know, to add new, like, as a cover crop, except for...
Right.
He didn't like, you know, like I've read about green manures and cover crops, and like you're supposed to pull it, or you're supposed to kill it before it flowers and then turn it in. But like, you know, he let them flower and like we're getting the fava beans. So, but I think he's still going to turn that into the soil.
Yeah, that's good. Although my suggestion, and I grow cover crops sometimes, is not to even turn it into the soil, because when you turn into the soil, you're mixing up the soil, you know, disrupting the fungi, disrupting the worms. And the other thing you're doing when you till a soil is you add a lot of oxygen to the soil, which actually burns up organic matter. So there are ways to deal with cover crops without tilling it in. On a home garden scale, a really easy way is to just grow a cover crop that winter kills. So I plant sometimes oats. And if I plant it and it grows, it really likes cool weather, so it grows really well, you know, into December even. And then come December, or when January comes around and super cold weather, it winter kills. It just flops down dead on top of the soil. And then by spring, just the tops, you can just sort of rake off without disturbing the soil, and you just plant. So that's a good way to get rid of cover crops without having to till.
Okay.
And there's a lot of research on this, even on a big farm scale. People use other methods for killing cover crops. These what are called crimpers that sort of knock it down and sort of cut it up into the surface.
Okay, cool. Because I haven't really heard about people using it on a big scale where they're not using chemicals to kill it and stuff like that. I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Or So it's good to know. Crimpers, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Well, did you have any other tips you wanted to share? Or do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year? Like, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, well, as far as another tip, I would say keep everything simple. People always trying to, I don't know why people, because it takes more time usually to complicate things in gardening. But, you know, people come up with all sorts of things. I know this will probably alienate some readers, but one of my pet peeves is compost tea. And perhaps you use it, but it's you know, it's something you can make, you can do. I mean, to me, compost tea, I spread compost on the ground. It rains, and there's compost tea going into the soil then. I don't make a, you know, a separate compost tea and water it on my plants. And there's a lot of research that doesn't support use of compost tea. So it's not just, you know, I'm not saying it's this great thing that it's not worth using. It's something that's not so great that's not worth using. It does have some benefits sometimes, and sometimes negative.
Okay.
So we can move into my failures.
Wait, tell us about something that grew well this year first.
Oh yeah, grew well. Well, I have to say that, you know, it's really amazing because I look at a lot of the commercial horticulture. You know, I get these bulletins from Cornell about, you know, what pests are around and say, you know, what sprays to put on things. And I have to say that, and maybe it's just luck, maybe it's because of how I'm taking care of myself, maybe it's, you know, how I time things, whatever. But, you know, in vegetables, for instance, generally I find them easy to grow. There's, you know, there's a few pest problems here and there, but I grow a whole bunch of different vegetables, which is also a good idea. Just grow a whole bunch of different things. And then if something fails, you got a lot of other stuff. But I have very few pest problems. It's just, so I would say this year, except for I think one crop, everything's growing really, really well. And that's usually the case.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of my guests have said that like the key to keeping pests away is healthy soil. I definitely think there's, like, one thing I've learned is it's a little bit easier for those of us that are in a northern climate, that some people in southern climates maybe have more pest problems that are a little harder to control than they are here where, like, we live or maybe where you live. But but definitely people have said, you know, the healthier your plants are, the healthier your soil, the less pests you're going to get in general. So
that's sort of a semantic thing, though. If you say, well, if your plants are healthy, you have less pests. That's sort of saying, that's sort of how you're defining plant health. So it's, you know, it's sort of like, it's hard to say in absolute terms what a healthy plant is because there are a lot of factors. But I guess not having pests is one way you could define it.
Yeah, and disease too would be a different category, maybe. And
here in the Northeast, we get a lot of pests and diseases generally, especially on fruit plants, you know, common fruit plants. And but you know, if you take care of things, generally things grow well. I mean, for instance, I try and grow plums here. And plums have a lot of pest problems, or not a lot. They have a few pest problems that are really bad. And basically a lot of years, you know, I don't get any plums, even though I try and control the pests. Whereas probably where you are, you have certain limitations, maybe for climate, but as far as certain insects that we have, you don't have. And you probably have a drier climate, so probably less disease also. Yeah.
I'm curious to see, we had a plum tree and this one year, it was so full of plums and they were so ripe and we were just about to pick them. And we go out there the next day and every plum is dead and dried up. And so then this year we have a new tree that is covered in plums again. And it has not given any plums any other year. And all of a sudden this year, we thought it was an apple tree, truth be told. And, or I did anyway, cause it hadn't. And then all of a sudden this year it's covered in plums. And so I'm curious to see, is it going to make it? Is it going to do the same thing? What's going to happen? So,
well, maybe you do have some of the diseases that we have, because that's what happens here too. I have a plum tree. One of my plum trees has nothing on it. My other one is loaded, but often as they ripen, they start to get this fuzzy white or fuzzy gray coating on them, and then they all rot and dry up. And that's a disease called brown rot, which is very common here in the East. And I didn't think it was that common out there, but maybe it is.
I don't know. We'll have to see what happens. So, because that one plum tree, the one that died, like we'd gotten a couple of plums off it. It was a pretty young tree. Like I think it was only 3 years old the year it died. But,
Yeah.
and then this one, like I said, it's been in there since I want to say like 2009, and this is the first year, or 2012, somewhere in there. This is the first year it's put out any fruit at all. And it is just
Huh.
covered in plums, and it's just so odd.
Well, good luck.
Yeah. So, well, how
I will
about?
tell.
Oh, go
Let
ahead.
me tell you about one of my
Yeah.
successes.
Okay.
So I have a small greenhouse. It's about 400 square feet. I guess it's
400
not that
square.
small.
Yeah.
20 by 20, and I get a lot of use out of it because I keep it just minimally heated so it doesn't freeze in there. But it can be there at 35 in the winter. And I use it to grow salad, fresh salad stuff all winter, which is nice. Just go out to the greenhouse, get a head of lettuce or fresh kale or celery or anything like that. And then the spring, I raise all the seedlings from my garden, which is a lot, in the greenhouse. And then summer, this is one of the best parts. I have four fig trees planted in the ground in the greenhouse, and they have trunks now. I planted them in 2001. They have trunks about 8 inches across. And first of all, they're grown. I have to control the growth because they can get very big in a greenhouse. And but a few years ago, I started getting this one pest, scale insects, which are very hard to control. And we used to try everything. We used to try like a toothbrush with alcohol going over the whole plant. I tried spraying oil. I tried a whole bunch of different things. And I grow figs outside in pots that I have to bring indoors in the winter to my cold basement. But then these scale insects, just every year they would get the better of me to the point where they would actually it'd be a race between fruits. Are they going to rot before they ripen or not? So I was really pretty bummed out. And then so I started reading about it, and it turns out there's some beneficial insects that can control this scale. So they weren't scale, they were mealybugs, which were related to scale. Anyway, I contacted this supplier of beneficial insects and bought two different types of beneficial insects. And released them into the greenhouse last year. I did one in about April, one release, and then I did another one sometime during the summer, just because it looked like the pests were building up again. And it was very effective. It was very expensive. It was very effective. So the beneficial insects cost about was it 80, $160 for So it was a lot. So and I figured I had about 160 figs, so it was about $1 a fig, which made it sound not too bad. So this year I was gonna all set to buy the beneficial insects again. But what I did last year, well, I did a few things. First of all, I screened the whole greenhouse. I was thinking maybe they're in there, and maybe the beneficial insects will overwinter there, and then won't be able to get out. So I'll have them in place. And then the other thing I was thinking that I never have these scale insects on my outdoor figs, but I do have them on the indoor figs. And what would the difference be? And then I raise the outdoor figs. Rain falls on them, and they have more humidity. So almost every day since they were just about to start growing, I've been giving them a really strong spray with a hose. And I have to say that I have not seen, and I look really carefully at the plants almost every day. I have not seen one scale insect, and the crop looks unbelievable. And I'm not sure if it's because I trapped the scale insects in there, or because I changed the microclimate in there, or both. But anyway, I'm very happy with the results. And I also trained, this is just an aside, but I trained the figs into an espalier form. So espalier is training plants to like a sort of a more like two-dimensional geometric form. So they're really cool looking. They have these one like a short trunk, main horizontal branch that's permanent, and then all the fruiting branches go straight up vertically. And it's pretty cool because the figs are just like lining all those vertical branches, and you just pick all the figs if you need them.
Wow. My mom has figs. She loves her figs. So these are all awesome tips. Now, how do you spell it? Is it SBIA or?
No, ESPALIER.
ESPIA. Oh, okay.
And I should mention that book I mentioned, The Ever Curious Gardener, I also have a little thing on SBIA there because I go into somewhat the science behind it, which really makes the pruning of SBIA more, I think it's more clear when you know why plants do what they do when you prune them a certain way.
Well, you are just like this very curious, for sure, scientific, like minded, you really seem to dig into like what you're learning, like really knowing your stuff and how all the science works and everything. And so it's no wonder your solutions are working.
Well, not always. Sometimes.
All
some
right.
Some things I haven't figured out yet.
Well, that goes right into our next question. Is there something you're excited to do different next year or even this year? Something new that you want to try or haven't done before?
Two things, especially. First of all, I'm very interested. One, I mentioned before that a lot of common fruit plants like apple, peaches, cherries, plums, they're very hard to grow because of pest problems here. And one common tree fruit that is not hard to grow are pears. So I currently have a collection of pears of maybe like 20 different varieties. So I'm going to increase my pear collection. And I'm really into grafting, so I make all the trees myself. I have the rootstocks, and I graft and I get the special varieties, and I graft them, and I make it. It's really fun to make a tree. And also I have a little thing on grafting in my new book, because grafting also, if you know the science behind what's happening, it sort of guides you better in why you're doing what you're doing. You can do it, what you're doing better.
Yeah. I had somebody come on and talked about grafting. I've had two people come on and talk about grafting, I think. One was talking about grafting tomatoes, and the other one talked about grafting fruit trees. So, cool.
Yeah,
well,
it's really fun.
It sounds fun. It's to me, it sounds, I don't know. It's kind of like, I don't know. I would think it would be complicated, but I'm not the green thumb at my house either. So,
Something else to try, something else for next year that I'm going to try. You want that? So I attended a lecture. I went to an organic farming conference last winter, and also I went to a workshop, the previous summer, and on beneficial nematodes, which, you can buy and you read about them. But so there's this thing when you buy beneficial nematodes, which can help with a lot of soil-borne insect pests. For instance, all those pests that tunnel into carrots and turnips and things like that, and plants like that. And also some of the fruit tree pests, like we have a pest of apples and plums and peaches called plum curculio, and it spends part of its life cycle in the soil, and beneficial nematodes can attack those in the soil. So one thing people can do is they can buy beneficial nematodes from a beneficial plant supplier. The problem with that is that you got to buy them every year. So there's been some research at Cornell about extracting beneficial nematodes from the native soils here. And these are ones that perennialize. In other words, they live year after year in the soil, and you can apply them to the soil, and they'll multiply in your soil, and you can actually grow them yourself. So that's my plan. It was my plan for this year, but I really got too many things going on, so I don't think it's going to happen. But next year I'm definitely going to do it. I have to get the whole protocol ready of how you do them. Basically, what you do is you buy wax worms, which I think are fishing bait or something, and you grow these nematodes on wax worms. You extract them, then you water them into the soil. So it's sort of an interesting thing to do, and it's beneficial, hopefully.
Wow. Well, I knew you were going to drop tons of golden seeds. So my listeners are very like kind of entrepreneurial and they're forward thinking and they're visionaries. And I'll bet there's somebody else out there going, hey, I wonder if I can start a business selling beneficial nematodes.
You could, except that then I'm trying to make it where you can just grow them yourself. No, I'm not. People have done this. There's researchers that have done this, but you can also do it at home. And the important part is that these would be perennial, ones that survive in soil, and they're native ones. So the ones I'd be getting to as starters would be from extracted from a soil in New York, which would probably be good anywhere in New England. But if somebody lived, say, in Louisiana, they should get their own beneficial nematodes extracted from the native ones, and those might be better. Those might survive better than ones from New York.
Yeah. Well, I just think all this is fascinating, and just I think it's great that you're trying to come up with these solutions for people because we know that I think that beneficials is one of the best ways we can improve our land and save our, eat healthier food without having to resort to, sprays and pesticides and herbicides and different things that people are putting on there that we don't want them to do. So, cool. Well, was there something that didn't work so well this season or last season that didn't come out? Here would be maybe one of your failures.
Well, one fair was leeks last year. I was all set. I grew leeks, and I was all set to harvest them, and then they all were sort of mushy. And I looked down inside with sheaths wrapped together, and there were these little, looked like eggs, and I still haven't figured out exactly what they are, which I'm going to start looking into very soon because I have leeks this year too, and I would hate for that to happen again. So I'm going to I have pictures of what about having a iPhone is, you just take pictures of anything that looks that you got to get back to. So I have pictures of it. I'm going to ask around and see if anybody could help me identify it, or I'll look in some books or on some websites, and then hopefully find out what it is and figure out an easy way to control it, or a non-toxic way to control it.
Okay, interesting. Nobody's talked about problems with leeks or even growing leeks. So cool. And I know my mom's a big leek fan, so.
And I've grown them for years and years. I never had a problem. It's the first time I ever saw it. But I think, on the one hand, I don't get too uptight when I see these problems. I'd like to have leeks, so it's not, I'd prefer not to lose them. But I do think there's one thing that keeps everything so interesting. Just different pests, sort of interesting, and then figuring out how to control them. And that's very satisfying when you figure out how to control them.
True. That sure is. We've definitely had our share of failures, and Mike is always, I always look at him. I'm like, oh my gosh, I just said that to him the other night. I was like, I don't know how you're so persistent with this and how you don't get so frustrated and just want to quit all the time. So
before we get to the root of things, we're going to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. Hey everyone. So I just want to remind you that we created a Patreon page. That's Patreon. And just go to patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. You can donate $8 per episode, which would hopefully get me back to 2 fresh episodes a week. And I know that you've learned from this podcast. I know it gives out great value. And so if you want to see it keep going and share it with other people, I could really use your help just paying the basics. Cost me at least $100 to keep this show up on the internet for hosting and the website and the calendar and just all the things that help keep it going together. There's also the Green Future Grower Book Club if you're interested in joining that for $10 a month, which would be amazing. We're going to go through books like the Elia Coleman, New Organic Gardener, or Jean Martin Fortier's Market Gardener book, or Lisa Ziegler's Cool Flowers. There's the John Jevons book, the Floret or Lynn Bazinski's flower books. Like, I already love the humus one. I think I'll do a much better job with this study group. So once a month, we'll be picking a different book and we can talk about how it relates to your garden. Only $10 a month to join that. We'll meet on a Zoom or a Google Hangout, and it will be just an amazing extended learning section. So I know I haven't done much to promote this, but please support our Patreon page at patreon.com/organic gardener podcast. That's patreon.com/organic gardener podcast.
And now let's get to the root of things. Well, so this is like kind of where I call getting to the root of things. And just Do you have a least favorite activity to do in the garden? Like something you got to force yourself to get out there and go do?
Least favorite, I would say, believe it or not, harvest. I really don't like harvesting. I like harvesting if I go out to the garden and, you know, say go out to the blueberries and just harvest them into my mouth. But we put away for winter. I grow, I have 16 blueberry plants. From 16 plants, we get about 200 quarts of blueberries, and we eat about half of them during the growing season, and the other half go into the freezer. So I really, I don't know why. I just don't like to stand there picking. Fortunately, my wife doesn't mind it, or maybe she likes it. Anyway, so she does most of the harvest, I have to admit, but I do everything else.
Well, that's good. I bet my husband wishes I would do half the harvesting. He just he's lucky sometimes if
no, she does. She does just about all the harvesting.
Well, good for her. Yeah, I mean, I like to eat the vegetables for sure more than I like to grow them. Although I'm getting better about it, but that harvesting thing is just like, I don't know, sometimes because it all comes on at once and then you're bending in all these weird shapes and, or, you know, stretching in different positions. And
That's good for you.
I know.
It's called yoga. Yeah,
you're right. It is. I do feel like I'm doing yoga in the garden all the time when I go down there, either to start weeding or, but I don't know. I feel like you get cramped up sometimes, like being in the same position for too long.
This is writing. So I write a weekly column locally in my blog, and one that was sort of funny, but I said that a new type of exercise sounds very Asian. It's called Rake King. And I said that Rake King was this exercise. I go out and I do scythe thing, and then my wife comes out and does Rake King. And there were other exercises too. We have mulcher size and, you know, things like that. Anyways, raking and scything. I have a part of that 2-acre field I bought. I let just grow up, and I cut it for hay with my scythe and use that for composting. But usually my wife, she wants to. I'm willing to rake it up, but she really likes raking.
I love that. Well, we've talked a lot on here about doing gardening CrossFit. And one of my first years, we even had a CrossFit Gardener of the Year, because some of my guests have just like, it just amazes me the things that they do in their garden and how much work goes into it. So for sure.
Well, it's nice. You know, it's nice on a garden scale, you know, a farm scale, you could spend 8 hours just picking something. But that's the nice thing about having a garden, even if it's a sort of a farmed in size, you get a lot of a broad range of activities. So you're not like getting sort of repetitive syndrome, you know, joint syndrome. But so, you know, you get to move a lot of different ways. I'm always thankful that I have this garden, and I get to go outside periodically or whenever I want and just move around different ways at the same time growing good tasting stuff.
Yeah. Well, my husband's definitely in super good shape because of the garden, I got to admit. And just like walking back and forth from our house to the garden, I think helps. We're kind of like the house is up on a hill. So every time you go down there, you got to walk back up that hill. Well, for sure. Well, good for you. So what's your favorite activity to do in the garden then?
So one of my a few things, but one of my favorites is making compost. I'm really, this probably goes back to my learning about soil and soil biology. So I make a lot of compost And I really, I remember for an article I was writing about compost once for a magazine, an editor came to take pictures, and he accused me, you know, he was being funny, but he thought that maybe I just had a garden as a place to use my compost. But the main thing was I really like the compost. But I make, like right now, I have about, I don't know, 10 or 12 compost bins, and each one holds almost a ton of compost. And I just make that all by hand. It's really enjoyable. And I never cease to be amazed at like, I put this, what looks like, you know, to most people, garbage in, and I get this beautiful compost out. And I put everything in my compost. Sometimes people say, well, don't put anything, you know, disease stuff in the compost. Don't put stuff that have insect pests in the compost. And I contend that if you look closely enough at any part of a plant, you'll probably find some insect, something that's not good. So, you know, then you'd put nothing in there. So I put everything in my compost, and sometimes I put less conventional things in it, like, you know, my old leather gloves. I can't see putting them in a landfill, so I put them in the compost, and it takes a long time for them to break down, but, you know, eventually they will. Put my old Levi's in the compost. That was sort of interesting. It was like a dryer cycle. It took about 4 cycles before it really was almost composted, and each time it looked more and more sheer till, you know, like almost the last one was like sheer polyester, except it was on its way out. And put my old underwear in the compost. That goes really quickly, and all that's left then is the elastic. But
you know, there was like a contest or some kind of thing on Facebook a couple of years ago where they were like, all right, we're challenging everybody to bury a pair of underwear in like June and then dig them up in like September and see what was. And they said, if you, and all that's left is your elastic, then you must have good worms and good soil.
I know about that. It was not it might have been a contest on Facebook, but there was the Agriculture Canada, which is the research, is sort of like the USDA of Canada. They were trying to figure out a good way, an easy way to see how biologically active a soil was. And that's exactly what they did. You can find on the internet where they showed you bury, they told, you know, how deep to bury it and everything. You take some underwear, cotton underwear, of course, and you put it in the soil, and then you dig it up after a certain amount of time. And depending on how decomposed it is, that tells how biologically active your soil is.
Cool.
So I put everything in the compost, and my garden, all my vegetable beds get an inch, and I don't till it in. I just lay an inch, at least an inch depth of compost on top of the beds every year. And it's really nice because it's very sustainable because I don't add any fertilizer. That's all the beds get. And these are very intensively planted beds too.
All right. Well, there's something we have in common is I love making compost too. And I kind of feel like you do. I don't like to throw anything away.
Yeah.
Because it does seem like a waste of a resource. I don't think I've thrown any jeans in the compost yet though, but we might start because Mike certainly goes through the Levi's.
Yeah, it was interesting. It's interesting because Levi's took a long time and my daughter had some jeans. They were not Levi's. And they composted in one cycle. All that was left was like the zipper, and you could see that, you know, the zipper and the snap on top, and that was it.
So, do you want to explain to listeners what you mean by one cycle? Is that like a summer, like a season, or like how long it takes you? I know Mike and I, like in the middle of heart of summer time around now, like when there's a lot of grass clippings. He can make a pile in like 2 weeks or so, but during other parts of the year, it takes a lot longer.
Typically what I do is I through summer, I'll be making compost. And for that compost, you know, as I said, I'll throw everything into it. But I also have this hay field that I, you know, cut. You know, I'll just spend 20 minutes with my scythe cutting, and that makes a lot of hay. And then there's a horse farm not too far away, and sometimes I'll get some horse manure, and I add a few other things to the compost. So I'll make compost throughout the summer. Then the following spring, I'll turn the compost, and I turn it just to make sure everything's mixed up nicely and to break up any clumps and to make sure – and I build my compost – if I'm doing a whole bunch at once, I water it as I build it to make sure it's not going to be too dry, and this way it'll compost quickly. and also gets hot. My compost typically get like 140 or 150 degrees, and so I make it through summer, turn it once in the spring to make sure everything's okay, and then use it by the end of summer. Although nowadays I have so much compost, I don't necessarily use it all then, but I'll use it, you know, I'll use it through the next season. And that would be one cycle. So the Levi's actually took a few cycles.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked that then, because that really explained it well. What's the best?
Go ahead. As far as another one of my favorite activities, I really like to propagate plants. I'm always like taking cut. I hate to, you know, if I'm pruning, say I grow black currants, and when I prune them, I know that each stem practically I can make into a whole new plant. So I can't bear to just throw away all the stems. At least some of them I got to make into new plants, or grapes when I prune them. So, you know, from cuttings or from seed, I really like propagating plants.
Cool. What's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
I guess one of the best things was when I first started gardening. Not only was I, as I said, going to graduate school and also reading a lot and gardening a lot, but when I just started, I actually visited Elliot Coleman and some.
Oh, you did?
Listeners might have heard of this way a long time ago, and I also visited Scott Nearing. I don't know if you heard of him, but anyway, they lived next door to each other. So when I visited Eli Coleman, I had told him that I was, you know, I was really a novice, and I wanted to plant strawberries. And I had read in these, you know, very reputable books that not to plant strawberries in ground that had been lawn just before, because lawn has grubs in it, and grubs really like to eat strawberries, and they'll kill the strawberries. So I actually happened to mention to Elliot, and he said, you know, it might happen, but just go ahead and plant, because, you know, maybe it won't happen. So I followed his advice, and the strawberries came out fine. So I think the advice that I gleaned from that, and that I sort of gave myself after that, was if in doubt, always just plant. Especially because when I started gardening, I was trying to put together like companion planting, succession planting, interplanting, rotation, and all this stuff. So much that I was going crazy. I thought I just couldn't bring myself to plant. And then I thought, you know, so maybe I won't do it 100% right, but I'm just going to start planting. So if in doubt, plant.
I like that advice for sure. And I think it kind of ties in with what you said earlier, was that if you plant a lot of stuff, a lot of things right. are going to come out. And if something fails, it's not that big of a deal, because you have all these other things that did work.
Right. There's tons of stuff that you know, whenever my wife, for instance, she bemoans that, you know, this thing is being attacked by some disease or insect, we always stop and just realize how much we get from the garden. And to, you know, lose something, it's really inconsequential.
Yeah. I mean, it's always sad when something doesn't work out. But I think, like you said, there's tons of other stuff that's coming up. So, and you kind of learn something for another year.
Yeah, and it's sad, but it's also interesting.
Yeah. How about, what's your favorite tool? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Yeah, I don't know about these one favorite. I got. How about if I pick three? So one would be a pitchfork. I think that's really key to having a good organic garden, because a pitchfork, you can move a lot of bulky organic materials around, and that's really, to me, one of the keys of gardening is, you know, bulky. You want to feed the soil organisms, and that's what they eat, bulky organic materials. That's like their carbohydrates. It is their carbohydrates. And then related to that, a scythe, only because I love using a scythe. And also it's a way to get bulky organic materials. You got the scythe, you got the pitchfork, and then you got to put in something. So I would say a good garden cart. You know, I have three big garden carts that can each hold like 400 pounds. And I get by for years with one, and then at garage sales, I picked up these other two, and it's almost like I can't figure out how I got by with just one.
I can totally relate to that, like, so much. Like, I'm always like, where am I going to put these weeds, or where am I going to put this, and
right.
how am I going to haul it out to the cut? And, like, when I first came up with this question, I thought the natural answer would be a shovel, but then I was like, no way, my wheelbarrow. But I want a garden cart. I think that's awesome, because we just have a wheelbarrow. And we could use, like, three wheelbarrows, I feel like, or a garden. Yeah, for sure. And then also for hauling, like, the vegetables up from Mike's mini farm now that he has down there is always, I get down there, I'm like, where's the basket? Where's the tray? Where's the this? And I hear you. And the more he grows, besides, the more we need.
Yeah, you got to be careful not to grow too much.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you overextend yourself, which I might have done already.
Yeah. Well, I always say start small, but we're kind of trying. Well, Mike's goal has always been to grow enough food for us for a year to try to, like, you know, at least maybe not replace our produce bill, but, it, you know, substantially, you know, what's it called? Like, whatever. Like, so we don't have as much produce to buy. And so, like, he's getting really close with potatoes. Beets last year, they were gone by, like, October because he grew golden beets for the first time, and then he sold some. But eventually, we would maybe like to go, I don't know. I don't know how we'll ever have enough water to sell enough food to go to, like, market, if we could ever be market farmers. So, but just the growth that he's gotten in the last 2 years from his mini farm has been huge.
Yeah, well, we do manage to grow, like, 99% of the vegetables we eat year-round.
Nice.
With the greenhouse, yeah. And a lot of the fruit, it wouldn't be 90%. We eat a lot of fruit, so it's not 99%, but it's a large percentage.
Cool. So, speaking of what you eat, like, what's your favorite recipe to cook or to eat from the garden?
That's funny that you should say that. I would say I have none. I really am not a great cook of garden stuff. Well, two things. One, I'm not really that good at cooking with garden stuff. And the second thing is, I really think if you have really high quality fruits and vegetables, that they don't really need a fancy recipe. Like, you know, certain, you know, you pick, I try and pick really good tasting varieties of things. And to me, maybe it's just my taste buds, but to me, that's just sufficient. I don't feel like I need to doctor them up.
I mean, think that's a perfect answer.
Okay, I'll stop at that then. Yeah. Yeah, I don't really. Especially fruits, I never cook the fruits.
No jams or anything?
Well, that also is related
Huckleberry
to
pancakes? All, blueberry pancakes?
Well, I don't really eat jam just because it's all that sugar in it. But I did try and make jam a couple of times. And one time, I grow a lot of gooseberries, which is, you know, famous for jam. And I did make a gooseberry jam once. And I have to say, it was the ugliest and most most foul-tasting jam I ever had. So I haven't tried that again.
That's fun. Cooking fruit. I get Mike and I, we keep talking about drying fruit. He wants to get, like, a dehydrator to dry some of our apples and things. Because I'm not a big enough fruit eater. I always need to get more fruit in my diet. So, well, how about...
We dry a lot of tomatoes.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yeah. Really good. They're really a treat all year round, but especially in winter. And we can tomatoes, too. But the dries are really good.
We know Mike struggles to get tomatoes. Like, we don't really can a lot of tomatoes and stuff because they just, like, our season, he just really struggles with too many green ones when you have to pick them. And then, like, being able to manage all those green ones, like, if they put them in a box and cardboard,
right,
them turning red, you know, whatever, in a paper bag and them turning red and then getting them in the canner at the right time. I don't know. We struggle with that here. But I like the dried idea.
Is that because you have a short season?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And an early frost. And, like, a lot of times we can get a frost in, like, August, late August, early September.
Oh.
So he's made, like, he'll make, like, these little plastic covers that work pretty good that can get us down to, like, 26 degrees. Or if he's made all sorts of, like, I don't know how many different types. Every season there's a different kind of plastic greenhouse thing to, like, extend it in the fall. And But yeah, we've just struggled with tomatoes. I like cherry tomatoes personally because they tend to ripen fast enough. But we're only 7 miles from the Canadian border. Like we're not only are we right up against the Rocky Mountains, but yeah, we're pretty north. So
you need a hoop house or a slightly heated greenhouse.
Yeah, he so wants one. And then he saw this thing on Facebook about those people that are doing like the geothermal greenhouses. Have you seen those? Guy in Nebraska with the greenhouse in the snow. Right.
Yeah, no, I would really like that. My greenhouse is not heated in any innovative way, but that would be really nice to have geothermal or something like that.
So, and then what he does in the spring here is like, so we have this porch off our kitchen, and so he'll cover that in plastic, and then he heats it from the house by opening the kitchen door and the kitchen window. But that takes a lot of firewood. And like this year, like it was almost March before I think he plasticed it in because it was so cold. And that'll take, you know, a couple of cords of wood just to heat that. So we're getting there. Every year we grow a little more. So how about a favorite internet resource? Is there somewhere you like to surf on the web?
So I don't generally like to surf, but when I do need information, this I think is a good tip because a lot of people, I thought everybody knew this, but when I search for information, you know, there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. So I think one way to get good information is to go to a site, you know, like a university or a government site. And the way you do that is if you put in, you know, your search terms, and then you put, after that, you put site colon either edu or gov, you get a university or a government site. And I think that's, you know, generally reputable information.
Cool. I like that tip. I'm always big on media literacy. And I definitely, those are always my first two. I don't put them into the search, but those are always the first one. Like I'll go through the first page or two on Google and look at ones that say those things.
Yeah, this way you don't even have to look, you know, you get that. That's all you get is university and government sites.
How about a favorite reading material or a book or a magazine or a blog or anything that you want to recommend?
Well, I would recommend my books. And besides that, I would recommend books by, once again, L.A. Coleman. And one particular book that I really like, a more recent one, is J.M. Fortier's The Market Gardener. I think that's a great book.
Yeah, that's been recommended a bunch on my show. But let's tell listeners about your book. So the one that was recommended that made me reach out to you, and it's been recommended a couple of times, is The Weedless...
Weedless Gardening.
Yeah, Weedless Gardening. And then we'll go ahead and tell about that and then tell about your other ones.
So that's a book that really focuses on no-till as a way not only to make your garden more weedless, but also a lot of other benefits besides that. I mean, the plants are, you know, healthier. The soil life is healthier. And another one of my books, which came out a few years ago, which is one of my favorite of my books, was called Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden. And it was basically all these fruits that have been grown and enjoyed by humans some part of the world, some not, but they're not well known. And the nice thing about them is they're easier to grow because they generally have less pest problems, and they have unique flavors, and some of them are really pretty landscape plants. And some of them are landscape plants that people don't even know you can eat them. For instance, juneberries. Do you have those out there?
We have juniper bushes, but that's different.
Juneberries. Well, juneberries is a commonly planted ornamental, and it makes great-tasting fruits. They taste sort of like sweet cherries with a hint of almond in them. So I have juneberries. I have a chapter on juneberries, a chapter on gooseberries, black currants, hardy kiwi fruit, which you could probably even grow that far north. Yeah. And I grow a lot of those. And I actually grow all the fruits that I mentioned in there. So they're all hardy fruits. They're not like tropical fruits that a lot of people wouldn't be able to grow. And so just like lingonberries I have there. Lowbush blueberries. So they're really fun fruits, easy to grow, and they look pretty. that was another book. And another book of mine, which actually is my best-selling book, is called The Pruning Book. It basically tells everything you possibly need to know about pruning of, you know, every kind of plant, and then some specialized types of pruning, including a whole chapter on what I mentioned before, espalier, you know, the training of the plants so that, you know, special forms.
Cool. Well, I'm sure so listeners are going to check out these books, and make sure you write Lee a review. If you get one off of Amazon, or even if you check it out of the library, you can still write him a review. Because I know my listeners are really interested in these things. Like a couple of people have come on and talked about fruit tree pruning have been very popular, downloaded episodes. And certainly, you know, gardening with fewer weeds is going to be a popular one. And no-till has been something that when John Moore first talked about that, came on my show when I was very first starting out, I had never even heard of that. But then since then, like, I've learned a lot about that. And we try to implement, you know, bits and pieces or parts of that whenever Mike can. I don't know.
The no-till is also easier. You don't have to till.
Yeah.
So it's one less thing to do.
When he built a mini farm, he cleared the forest land. I don't know, for the first time, using that dirt, if you can do it that way, you know, because he was digging up everything because he had to get the stumps out there from the trees with backhoe and things. Right. I think that first time. And then we got the broad fork that G. Martin Fortier recommended, and then he used that for the most part this year.
Yeah. I have to admit, I've never used a broad. Well, I did use it once because everybody kept saying I should do it every once in a while. I didn't see any good reason that I would need to do it. So I think it was the year before last, I bought a broad fork, and I did a little test in some of my beds. I broad forked part of them to see what would happen. And as I predicted, nothing happened from the broad forking. But that's because, you know, I don't walk on my soil at all, ever. I mean, in the beds, so there's no compaction, and I guess that would be the main reason. You know, if you're going to compact them at all, broad fork's good for loosening it up. But once you have them formed, if you don't step on them at all and you keep on adding organic matter, which helps loosen it up, I don't see any reason to broad fork it, although a lot of people might disagree with me. I know Elliot did disagree with me.
So I'm trying to visualize how this, so you have your beds, you pull your crop out, you put let's say you're pulling out carrots. So then you put all the carrot greens back on top and then put a layer of compost on top and then plant your seeds the next year.
No, when I clean up the garden, I put everything I take out of the garden into to make compost. And then the only thing I put on the beds is compost. So the carrot tops go into the compost pile.
Oh, okay. Got it. Great. Well, that makes sense. Okay. Well, and that probably makes your soil just super high quality, easy to plant right in. You probably don't even need a shovel. You can probably just dig a hole with your fingers to put your seeds in.
Yeah. Yeah. You could dig a hole 8 inches deep with your hand. I mean, it's just a picture of soil that's had an inch or more of compost laid on top of it for 30 years without turning it in. You know, and the compost decomposes and melds with the soil, but it really becomes this just fluffy, nice material.
Yeah. Nice. Well, I love that about deep beds and just different places. Like Mike's really built his soil up a lot, so I can totally relate to that. Well, how about I don't know. Do you have any kind of business advice or advice for people about maybe going to school or I don't know?
Well, I think I know people often shy away from book learning in agriculture because, as I said, you can get by without it because nature wants to seeds to grow and plants to grow. But I do think that, if you choose the right books, you really get some benefit from that. And as far as business advice, I really sell stuff. I actually sell a few things, but mostly I don't sell. But I know from my limited experience in selling things, I would say that the main thing is that the thing that sells is quality and uniqueness. So I have three, that book I mentioned, Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden. So three of the fruits that I grow, three of those uncommon fruits I grow, I sell. And that's pawpaws, hardy kiwi fruit, and American persimmons. And they both, first of all, they're very unique, so that sells. And also the quality. When I've sold them, I give people a taste of it, and I feel sort of guilty. It's almost like being a drug dealer, because I know if they taste it, they're going to have to buy it. And they do. It's amazing. They taste them, and they just pay good money for these things.
Cool. Well, that's a great advice for people out there listening. And, I talked to this guy, Bob Quinn, who's like on the other side of the mountains, on the east side from me, where it's really dry and they don't do a lot of irrigation. And he grows like a lot of the fruits I think you're talking about. And his goal, I think he said he grew like 27 different fruits on his property. And so that's his kind of goal, is to eat locally all fruit that's locally grown. So I think listeners will really enjoy this. All right. Well, here's my final question. It's kind of a doozy. So if there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about, or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel, Lee, is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
So this is not related to agriculture exactly, but my belief is that population control, or not letting population just grow without just grow too fast or grow at all, perhaps, is one thing that's really hurting the planet and hurting not only for resources, but I think many people, they get on each other's nerves. But and one way to do that, which I really believe in, because I've read something about this, is with supporting education of girls throughout the world. Because there's a lot of parts of the world where girls are not allowed to be educated. For instance, in Afghanistan, was it? Now I forgot, Malala. Now I forgot her last name. So that's one organization which I have donated to, and I think organizations like that help girls get education. And the reason is because they found there's a relationship between it's better for the girls. That's one reason. And the other reason is because when girls get more educated, they have less children.
Yeah, that is totally a thing after my own heart. Like I always say, like my three biggest priorities is like water for everybody, healthy food, and then an education for everybody everywhere around the world. For sure, it definitely makes a huge difference. And I always I hear people constantly talk about, why do these women have 7 kids? Why are they so poor? Why do they have all these kids? I'm like, where are they going to know how not to, where are they going to get access to not having kids from, and the education, whatever, way they're going to go about it? They probably just, that's their way of life. And I think that's
so important. And when they get educated, they also have, a better life, too.
Yeah.
Besides that.
I'm 100% in agreement with you. And the other thing they say is, educated countries that have people with higher levels of, higher education, more college degrees, tend to have higher, environmental policies and, just better all-around environmental stewardship. So
right, except for us now. if I might throw that in.
I didn't want to go there, but yep, you're for sure. So, well, not that you haven't given a million other great tips and golden seeds, like I said, but do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
Well, I would say plant. That'd be one thing, just plant. And the other thing is to, especially for beginners, because beginners often, even advanced gardeners maybe, is to have, so there's two things that really guide my gardening. And one is to have a lot of faith in science. I think science can answer a lot of questions. And then some people might think there's the opposite, but I think it goes hand in hand. But I have a lot of faith in natural systems. a lot of what I do in the garden, I'm trying to emulate what happens in nature. For instance, the no-till, that's, you know, in nature, things, the soil doesn't get tilled up. You know, the organic material gets laid on top of the ground. So just have faith in natural systems that they, you know, they work out, and try and emulate them. And I think you have a better garden. Like, you know, you don't plant 2 acres of one crop. You mix this together. There's a lot of things that happen in nature that are opposite to what a lot of people do in agriculture. And I think if you have faith in natural systems, you can emulate them and things work better.
Cool. Well, I love everything that you've shared with us today. And I just really appreciate you taking the time. I just looked at the clock. I can't believe you're probably like, oh my gosh, is this interview ever going to end? So just want to tell listeners like your website or how they would connect with you really quick, and then I'll let you go.
So my website is www.leereich.com. And from that, you can link to my blog, which is a weekly update of what's happening on my farmden. And also there's some videos and workshops if you're not too far away. I do workshops periodically here. And that would be it. And books, too, you can get from the website.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, Lee. And you have an awesome day.
Good. Thanks for having me. It's been fun. But now I got to get out to the garden. Farmed it.
Hey, everyone. So I just want to remind you that we created a Patreon page. That's Patreon. And just go to patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. You can donate $8 per episode, which would hopefully get me back to 2 fresh episodes a week. And I know that you've learned from this podcast. I know it gives out great value. And so if you want to see it keep going and share it with other people, I could really use your help just paying the basics. You know, cost me at least $100 to keep this show up on the internet for hosting and the website and the calendar and just all the things that help keep it going together. There's also the Green Future Grower Book Club if you're interested in joining that for $10 a month, which would be amazing. We're going to go through books like the Elia Coleman, you know, New Organic Gardener, or Jean Martin Fortier's Market Gardener book, or Lisa Ziegler's Cool Flowers. There's the John Jevons book, the Floret, or Lynn Bazinski's flower books. Like, I already love the humus one. I think I'll do a much better job with this study group. So once a month, we'll be picking a different book and we can talk about how it relates to your garden. Only $10 a month to join that. We'll meet on a Zoom or a Google Hangout, and it will be just an amazing extended learning section. So I know I haven't done much to promote this, but please support our Patreon page at patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. That's patreon.com/organicgardenerpodcast. Hey there, Green Future Growers. Would you like your friends and neighbors to create an organic oasis too? Would you like others in your area to learn about earth-friendly practices for their gardens and yards? If so, we would love it if you would share the Organic Gardener podcast with your local community or college radio station today. Thanks again for listening, and remember, grow local.